Atlanta's new soccer team may not have many players at this point or even a head coach, but it has a lot of fans. The team has set a new record for the most season tickets sold for an expansion team. Atlanta United will make its debut at Mercedes-Benz Stadium in 2017. And joining now is Darren Eales. He's team president of Atlanta United. Good morning, Darren.
Good morning, Celeste.
And also joining us is Tara Goodwin-Rufus. She's the events director for the Atlanta Soccer Support Group, Terminus Legion. Hello, Tara.
Good morning.
So, Darren, as team president of Atlanta United, what does that make you responsible for?
So I'm in charge of the whole club. So on the technical side, all the sort of putting the staff together, the team, the head coach, all the sort of technical side of things, but also the business side. So in terms of the tickets, the sponsorship. So I'm sort of in charge of it all. And then I've got Carlos Bocanegra in charge of the technical department, who's a former national team player, played 110 times for his country. And then Anne Rodriguez, who came to me from Under Armour, where I knew her when I was working for Tottenham Hotspur.
The clothing manufacturer.
That's right, yeah. And when I was at Tottenham Hotspur in the English Premier League, we were the first people to go with Under Armour. So that's how I knew her.
All right, let's hear a little bit from the team owner, Arthur Blank. Here he is talking about Atlanta actually becoming part of Major League Soccer.
The league has grown tremendously in the last 10 years, financially, in terms of partners, other owners, stadiums, markets that are covered. This is the largest market in the United States that doesn't have an MLS franchise now. So we couldn't be more excited. We think the time would be exactly right. And we look forward to being, you know, the 22nd team in MLS.
Tara, many people in your group have been trying to get soccer to Atlanta for quite some time. Do you agree with Arthur Blank that the timing is right at this point?
Absolutely. The timing is always right.
Would you have said that if it was 5 years ago?
I personally would have. I've been involved with the soccer community for a long time. I've played, I've coached, I've reffed, I've done it all. It's been ready. I think now is a better time, but anytime.
Why do you say that?
Time.
Why is now better?
It's MLS is growing as a whole. Soccer in Georgia is growing as a whole. You see more and more youth leagues coming out. You see more and more competitive leagues that we didn't used to have. There's a lot more soccer in Atlanta and Georgia as a whole than people even realize.
Darren, is it easy or difficult to attract players to a brand new team?
There's a little bit of both. It's difficult in the sense of it's a leap of faith, particularly as it's a global game, soccer. So we're going to be taking a lot of our players from overseas as well. So what we found, though, is once we started to attract the players, so we've got, signed a guy called Kenwyn Jones, who came from Trinidad and Tobago, playing the English Premier League for 10 years. Once he signed on board, then that gives us a lot more credibility now as we're going out to recruit other players. And a great thing for us is Atlanta is, you know, it's a wonderful city. It's very international, easy to get to with the airport. But the other good thing is the standard of living. We are in a salary cap environment, competing against New York and LA. So when we can actually say, look, this is this wonderful city and actually your dollar's going to go further, that actually helps us in a salary cap environment.
Let me actually play you a comment that you made earlier. This is from 92.9 The Game here in Atlanta.
I mean, I've learned it quickly as I've come to the city. It's a city with a lot of transplants. So we were finding that people were saying, you know, this could be a team that they could unite behind. It was something where, you know, you come from Pittsburgh, you might be a Steelers fan, but you're not a soccer fan of anyone in Pittsburgh. So actually, this could be Atlanta's team.
There's also a sense that in a certain way, the soccer team could take advantage of how the poor season some of the other major teams are having and have had in Atlanta. Do you feel as though it sounds like you're saying not only could you get Atlanta fans, but you could draw fans from other cities?
Yeah, I mean, I think the big thing for us, and we talked about timing, I think the timing was great for Atlanta to have the team now because the league's grown. But I think the interesting thing was there were a lot of skeptics that Atlanta wouldn't necessarily be that good a sporting city. People have talked about the city, the Thrashers leaving the ice hockey team. And we've just now broken the record ever for expansion teams at 22,000. We've still got 6 months to go. So I think the interesting thing for the rest of the country has been how behind the sport the whole city's got. And I think the element of that, and I spoke about it on that clip, is this idea that no one's really, a lot of transplants here, a lot of people new to the area, and they don't carry the baggage of a former soccer team that they supported. So this is a team they can unite behind. Now, we're not looking at the other teams and thinking because they're doing poorly, that's going to help us. I think it's in everyone's interest for the whole of Atlanta to get behind its teams. And I'm actually quite excited about the fact that we've got a chance to rewrite the narrative of Atlanta. I think as we come into 2017, a lot of stories are going to be written about the amazing phenomenon of the city getting behind the team. And I'm hoping that that helps to sort of change this this wrong, you know, the narrative is incorrect that Atlanta doesn't support its teams. I mean, it's crazy to say that when you look at what we've done here, the Falcons sell out their stadium week after week. So I think there's this lazy journalism almost that Atlanta's not really a sports city, which is not really getting behind the truth.
Tara, what if the team struggles at first? What if it's not losing? Are you concerned about that ticket sales could go down?
No, not at all. We get behind our teams every single time, even as we were supporting the Silverbacks. We were there at every single game, cheering them on. It doesn't matter. Every team's going to have their season. Every team's going to have a bad season. So we'll be behind them 100% no matter what.
So there has been for a long time, and I mean decades in the U.S., a narrative about trying to sell soccer or football, clearly yeah. You're from across the pond, to Americans, and that nobody's ever quite convinced that that will happen, that America will ever fall in love with soccer. So I'm going to put this to both of you as to whether or not the recent interest in especially the women's Olympic team and the World Cup, whether or not we have turned at least a small corner when it comes to soccer.
I definitely think we have. I mean, I played over here 20 years ago when the league started. And when I played, it was still in that time where they were trying to Americanize soccer. So the idea was it wasn't high scoring enough for American fans to get into it. So they were...
You can end a soccer game after a very long time with zero
absolutely
goals.
But you can have some of the best games in the world to be nil-nils. But the interesting thing was they were trying to, I don't know, increase the goal size, take team fouls from basketball, trying to import things from other sports into soccer. And then about 15 years ago, they decided just to keep it authentic, the same as in the rest of the world. And what's happened is I think the increasing, you know, the population, the fact that now on social media you can watch a game anywhere in the world. I think that the kids growing up have played the FIFA computer game, for example. They understand soccer, they know about it. And so now I think we found that this is why it's suddenly growing and that everybody understands the game. They realize the game for what it is. And now, I mean, look at it, 22,000 already that we sold without even kicking a ball. That's higher than the NHL average of 17,400, the NBA average of 17,450. So it just shows you when you put it
into
that context.
How big was that celebration that Friday?
Yeah, pretty big, yeah.
Tara, let me put the same question to you. You have been involved in soccer for a very long time. And you coach, what ages do you coach?
I've coached all the way from 5 up to 12.
So how do you feel, especially as you've watched generations come and go who maybe haven't gotten a passion for soccer, do you think we have turned this corner?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Growing up playing soccer, I was, it's a girl's sport. It's a girl's sport. No one's ever going to pick it up. Now you have a huge female following, like you said, for the women's team. That was the highest rated game watched. They're bringing in all sorts of fans, girls. But you see a lot more boys playing, too. I've come up coaching, and I've heard from all the parents. And a lot of parents used to use soccer kind of as that filler season. Now you see more and more kids are playing every single season. Not only are they playing outdoor soccer, now they're playing indoor soccer. Every chance they get, they're on the field. So I definitely think we've turned a huge corner, and it's just getting bigger and bigger.
I'm speaking about the new soccer team in Atlanta, Atlanta United, and I'm speaking with Darren Eels, team president, and also Tara Goodwin-Rufus, who you just heard. She's with the soccer support group, Terminus Legion. Darren, are you concerned about some of the traffic woes people are predicting for the new stadium?
No, and for our fans in particular, we've got the Martyr, so that's something that our demographic, it's a lot more on the sort of millennial generation who tend to use Martyr. So for us, I think in particular, we feel that that's going to be a great solution for us. And the big thing for us was to be downtown. So what you've seen over the last 20 years in Major League Soccer is a move away from stadiums out in the suburbs to be more in the downtown locations, because we get, like Tara's group, Terminus Legion, the supporters group are a part of the show at a soccer game. So our fans will be, we have a supporters section that's going to be the largest in MLS. We've already sold over 3,000 in that section. And they will be putting up big flags, they call TIFOs, big demonstrations around the game. And they become part of that engine room, part of that noise of the game. So, you know, to be downtown, to create that energy was really important for the soccer team. And that's, you know, something that we're really excited about.
When do we find out who the head coach will be?
In the next couple of months, we're hoping to get someone in place because we have an expansion draft in December. So it's important for us to have that head coach in place before we have the expansion draft.
Tara, who's your dream player to come to Atlanta?
Oh, wow. I would love to see Luis Robles, but that won't happen.
Probably will not happen. Anybody second on that list?
Oh, the most unrealistic I could probably ever come up with would be Messi, of course.
Noted then.
Don't think that's going to happen either. So Darren, it's impossible now to make predictions about the team because we don't have all the players. We don't have a head coach. But are you prepared for, I mean, in the first year, often brand new teams really struggle. Are you prepared for that as a team, prepared for a team that the first couple of years is going to have a hard time?
Yeah, I mean, look, we've looked at, you can't sort of argue with the facts. One in the last 10 expansion teams hasn't made the playoffs. But having said that, we've got an owner in Arthur Blank that's fully committed to make this a winning team. He hired me nearly 2 years ago to start the sort of the planning and the to make sure that we give ourselves the best possible opportunity to be competitive from the start. And that's what we've tried to do in every area of the squad. We're trying to get the best player we can for that position. So whether that is, we started a, what they call an affiliation with a lower division team in Charleston. And we were the first team to ever do that before we started playing. And the reason for that is it gave us a chance to house some players early. So that was to try and get them acclimatized from abroad so that they could be up to speed when we start playing in 2017. We were the first team ever to start their academy, the under-12s to under-18s, before the first team started. And again, that's because we're not going to get an instant fix with our academy, but the sooner we start putting the building blocks in place, the quicker we can be more progressive. So I think, you know, it's a long answer, but we want to be as competitive as we start. And Tara touched on it earlier, you know, I think from our perspective, when we sign the players, we're not necessarily going to sign a player because it's going to sell tickets, but because we want to be competitive.
That's Darren Eales, team president of Atlanta's new soccer team, Atlanta United. Tara Goodwin-Rufus is director of events for the Atlanta Soccer Support Group, Terminus Legion. The team begins its first season next year at Mercedes-Benz Stadium. Darren and Tara, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's on Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. Officials in Newton County have blocked construction of a cemetery in the Atlanta suburb of Doraville. The imam behind that project, the proposed project, says it is too costly to bury members of his congregation in the existing cemetery miles away. So he wants to create one in nearby Newton County and then have an adjoining mosque where people can pray. But he says his cemetery would be open to all faiths for burial. He told producer Sean Powers about this. This is about community building.
Our objective, you and me, everyone, if we want to live side by side, peacefully, obviously, you got to look at me and I got to look at you. You got to take care of me, I got to take care of you. When someone comes from, somebody died. Okay, if they come, so I'm going to see him, I'm going to talk to him. More I meet, more I talk, this fear and the doubt, okay, that will be gone.
I'm joined by Atlanta attorney Edward Ahmed Mitchell. Mitchell leads the Georgia chapter of the Council on American Islamic Relations. Welcome.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
What is at issue here in terms of the legal use of this land? Can it not move forward without the commissioner's approval?
So Newton County law fast tracks the construction of houses of worship. It's actually somewhat unique. If you're a church, a synagogue, a mosque, they let you move forward with your house of worship and your cemetery without the normal zoning process that other buildings would have to go through. For years, churches have made use of that right. But when a Muslim house of worship sought to do so, pandemonium erupted. The public was very upset. A few commissioners made inappropriate remarks in public. And then obviously the commission voted to institute a moratorium blocking all houses of worship for 5 weeks. CARE, the NAACP, the ACLU, Project South, and others believe that moratorium is unconstitutional because it was motivated by opposition to the specific faith of this specific project. That's why we've all come together to call for Newton County to lift the moratorium and then take their time, work with the mosque, work out the details. As you heard from the imam, he's incredibly flexible. He's in no rush to build the mosque. He is in a rush to build bridges with his neighbors. But the moratorium must be lifted as a matter of law.
It could be difficult to build bridges with some of the neighbors. Let's hear a couple comments from people in that area. Nora Forbes here lives in Newton County, the town of Oxford. She says the community would be less safe if the mosque and cemetery were built.
God forbid if someone get raped, their culture believe in honor killings. I don't want that brought here. We already have enough mess here already, and we don't need more mess here. And we do believe in different gods. At least I do. I believe in Jesus. I think they believe in Muhammad. I would be terribly upset if one of my kids chose to be a Muslim.
I want to play one more comment from two other people. This is Sue Blocker of Conyers and Ann Irvin of McDonough, who also oppose the building of the mosque and cemetery.
We're a Christian, and this is a Christian nation. It's not a Muslim nation. in their Quran, it says to kill all Christians in the 9th chapter of it. So, you know, all of that is the reason I'm against it.
We don't need that many people of that nationality that close to us. I'm sorry.
Does it create security concerns for you?
Yes, it does. Very muchly so. Terrorists. Will they infiltrate?
So just a quick fact check there. The Quran actually says fighting is allowed only in self-defense. The passage she's referring to does not mention Christians. It was about a specific group of Meccan pagans who had declared war on Muhammad and his followers. Just want to make that clear. But you are not here to defend Islam. We're talking about just this this mosque and this cemetery. And the cemetery, he says, will be open to all and anybody of any religion. Why do they need it?
Well, first and foremost, in a way, I am here to defend Muslims. I mean, the reason there's opposition to this mosque and cemetery is anti-Muslim animus. So if we're going to solve the issue with the mosque, you have to address the underlying issue, which is fears about Islam. You just heard some pretty remarkable things from some of the people of Newton County. And I want to say this. I do not blame the people of Newton who hold these anti-Muslim feelings. If I was not a Muslim and I didn't have any Muslim friends and all I knew about Islam was what I saw in the evening news, I wouldn't want a mosque in my backyard either. So I don't blame them for that. I don't want to argue with them. I want to educate them. The things that we just heard are so blatantly false and so easily disprovable that all we need to do is get in front of the people and answer their questions and explain Islam to them. And I think that'll go a long way towards addressing the issue with the mosque. And that's why the imam is meeting slowly with church and community leaders in the area to address their concerns. That's why I, God willing, plan to go to Newton County and deliver one of CARE's Islam 101 presentations this week. And I'll keep going back as often as I need to reach as many people as I need to, because these are all easy concerns to address, because the truth is that Islam is a peaceful religion. Muslims, Christians, and Jews do worship the same God. Muslims, Christians, and Jews do share many similar values. We have some different theological beliefs, of course. Muslims have a Unitarian view of God versus a Trinitarian view. That is true, but that doesn't mean we can't be neighbors and agree to disagree without being disagreeable. As for your question about whether or not they need the mosque and the cemetery, yes. In fact, a Newton Muslim wrote an editorial in their local paper yesterday announcing that he supported the mosque because it's very inconvenient for him to have to travel to another county to worship God. And he also noted there are many several doctors in Newton County who are Muslims, and for them, they have to also travel outside the county to go worship God. It would be much more productive for them to stay close to their hospitals, close to work, and be able to get more work done and worship in the area. So yes, there's a need for the mosque and the cemetery, and whether there was a need or not, they have a legal right to build a house of worship.
John Douglas is a Newton County commissioner. He represents the area included for this proposed mosque and cemetery. He has some concerns about the project. He did an interview with a Rockdale Citizen and said, quote, "Would building those things make us a prime area for the federal government to resettle refugees from the Middle East?" End quote. We did reach out to Douglas. He declined our request for an interview and suggested we reach out to the county's attorney. The county's attorney did not respond to either email or phone calls. So I want to play a comment from Muhammad Islam. And he says that he will not pursue legal action as they move forward.
No problem at all, because our goal is not to achieve that land. We already own the land. I want to win your heart. Graciousness is the way to live together, not the demanding the right. What I learned from Muhammad, peace be upon him, from Jesus, peace be upon him, from Abraham, they sacrificed. They did not demand their right.
Why not pursue legal action if you have a legal right to build it?
Well, like the imam, I'm a devout Muslim, and the Quran teaches us that good and evil cannot be equal. Respond to something wrong with something better, and the person with whom you had enmity will become like your close friend. That's in the Quran. It's basically the same theory that Martin Luther King used to try to defeat segregation. So that is the imam's goal, is to use basically a turn the other cheek strategy to win the hearts and minds of the people. Having said that, this is America. We have laws that must be upheld, and whether or not I or the imam want to pursue private legal action, which we don't, the Justice Department obviously might have an interest in making sure the Constitution is upheld. So that is why I certainly hope that the Newton County commissioners will lift the moratorium on their own before there is a need for outside federal intervention. I hope it does not come to that. I don't think it will come to that. I've been very inspired over the past few days by the fact that several mayors in Newton County sent a letter. I think all the mayors in Newton County sent a letter to the county commission saying, lift the moratorium, work with the mosque, and also as well, individuals individuals have been contacting me with very positive messages. So I'm hopeful that this is going to get resolved without outside intervention.
Well, it sounds like Mohammed Islam is actually going himself to meet with many of these people. Let's hear one more comment.
When you plant a tree, you cannot expect that the fruits is going to come right away. You got to wait, be patient. 1 year, 2 years, then down the road, 3 years, the fruits is going to come. Okay? You are not doing it only for you. It's for everyone.
Do you expect it could take up to 3 years before this is resolved?
No. I expect that the imam is going to take his time building the mosque because he wants to first build bridges with his neighbors. However, the moratorium has to be lifted because it is illegal. So once the moratorium is lifted, then the imam and the county commission can sit down, take their time, meet with their neighbors, make sure that everyone is on the same page and everyone's going to be friends and friendly. So they're really two separate issues. That's why the moratorium is all the more remarkable, because it's not like the mosque was going to be built tomorrow. You know, they were going to take their time. They were going to have to still go through a regular process. And that's what makes the moratorium, which undermines Newton County law as well as the Constitution, all the more unnecessary.
What do you do then if this has exposed rifts that already existed between the community and the Muslim community? We're just talking about people that live there. What do you do now with that portion of it? Yeah. As you say, there's the legal issue, and then there's this other thing, which is the comments that we heard earlier.
And I think that's just as important, because you know this misinformation about Muslims can sometimes lead to hate speech, and hate speech sometimes leads to hate crime. So for the sake of Muslims and non-Muslims, all Americans, I think it's very important that people of different faiths learn about each other. I think it's very scary when people don't realize what they don't know. And I think my hope and the imam's hope is to use this incident as an opportunity to educate the people of Newton County about what their American Muslim neighbors really believe in. We believe in God. We believe in tithing annually. We believe in doing good and avoiding wrong and treating our neighbors well, no matter their faith. And these extremist groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda do not represent Islam any more than the KKK, Eric Robert Rudolph, or Timothy McVeigh represent Christianity. So that's the message we want to deliver to our neighbors. And we also want to answer their questions. So that's what we plan to do.
Edward Ahmed Mitchell is the executive director of the Georgia chapter of the Council on American Islamic Relations. Thank you so much.
Thank you. God bless.
Muhammad Jamal Dawoodi understands discrimination against Muslims firsthand. He's the imam of the Islamic Society of Augusta. In July, an anti-Muslim activist armed himself outside the Islamic Community Center of Augusta and made threats against Muslim lives. He mentioned Muhammad Jamal Dawoodi by name. We spoke with the imam back in March about the work he does to increase understanding of Islam in his community.
The sense of generalization that all Muslims are terrorists, and connecting, you know, some kind of pictures or video clips that they see on the TV with a ritual that is very holy and important for the Muslims, whether they are calling for the prayer or praying or performing whatever rituals. That is really hurting for the larger Muslim population.
So do you think that a leader of a congregation, like an imam, a rabbi, or pastor, also has that kind of relationship where they might be able to see radicalization beginning to happen?
Well, we are. I myself and majority of the imams that are, you know, Islamic centers, that we are working closely with the law enforcement agencies in order to detect and, yes, report any kind of suspicious activity. But in this discussion, in this argument, we need really to bring up a kind of a public discussion between legislators who are planning or working on creating those guidelines, and the trainers and the Muslim community, or experts from the Muslim community. These trainers supposed to be either from the Muslim community or working closely with the expert from the Muslim community in order to help them. Because we need to be very careful about these guidelines or these detection, not to fall in the area where we you know, ban or hurt the freedom of speech or freedom of practice in that situation. We need to be very careful in this, because I disagree with the, you know, generalizing and painting these kind of radical behavior with Islam or Christianity or Judaism or any other faith. These are kind of behavior, and Islam is just like any other faith. It is what you bring into. If you have a violent character before you are a Muslim, you will continue to be like this. So yes, there should be a kind of close cooperation between the law enforcement agencies, between the legislators, between the leaders of the Muslim community nationwide, in order to come up with the right policy for that.
We asked Putnam County Sheriff Howard Sills about whether or not he thinks he should incorporate sensitivity training along with training on recognizing radicals. Here's what he had to say.
Obviously, you don't want to offend someone, but you can observe somebody praying without offending them. I don't see how the simple gathering of intelligence as it relates to potential criminal activity could reach a point where you would do something that was insensitive.
What's your response to that?
Yes, that kind of activity will hurt the Muslims, again, because we are linking a kind of negative evil action to a peaceful, beautiful, law-abiding citizens and followers of certain faith. Sensitivity training, it is important. It is important to run it. And if we did not do it, we are a little bit late. I have been part of many of those programs provided by wonderful Muslim organizations nationwide. Lots of changes, really, and good fruit will come out from that kind of sensitivity training. Because the bottom line, we want to get to the result, to the fruit, to the end of that one. And we have to use all the tools that we can do in order to achieve that properly. And in order not to mess up with the right of practice and the right freedom of speech and others as a normal law-abiding law citizen.
Is it the responsibility, though, of an imam like yourself or a pastor or a priest to identify people who have been radicalized?
It is the responsibility of everybody. Everybody in his own office, in his own job, in his own mission, had that responsibility, to report and identify that. Yes, if I would see any kind of suspicious activity, we have zero tolerance for that in our center. So it's not only those radicals, you know, as long as they are connected to a community, so the community itself will be able to identify them and report them and help out with this problem. But if we are trying to put a certain limit and a certain policy, certain principle, they might be working underground, and that it will be harder on the Muslim community and even on the, you know, law enforcement agencies to detect them. So we need to we need to be very careful not to hurt the innocent one. At the same time, be smart and you know, wise enough to tackle this issue from different sides.
Mohammed Jamal Daoudi is the imam of the Islamic Society of Augusta. I spoke to him in March. REM made the world listen. The band got together in Athens in 1980, and they eventually changed the sound and scope of alternative pop.
Starts with an earthquake, birds and snakes, an airplane. Lenny Bruce is not afraid.
A reissue of the band's iconic Out of Time album will be released in November for the 25th anniversary. In 2014, an MTV documentary explored the band's Georgia roots. The film used hours of archival interviews with band members to tell the story from the earliest days. And at the time, I spoke with producer Alex Young and editor Dave Leopard, and also Jordan Stepp, a major REM fan who runs the Athens Music Junkie blog. I asked Alex and David why they chose to focus on REM's early days.
Well, we really wanted to tell a complete story as possible, and when we first started our research, we weren't really sure, you know, if that was going to happen. But as we went through the footage, it became clear that we have a full story here, and why not tell the full story?
Well, let's bring Jordan into this conversation. You actually had the chance to host Mike Mills at your college radio station. Mike Mills is the bass guitarist for REM and one of the founding members. This is when you were at the University of Georgia. And this was in December of 2008 on WUOG-FM. So let's first, you provided us with a clip of him speaking on that broadcast. Let's take a listen.
90.5 FM is WUOG, Athens. And the Mike Mills victory sled to hell continues. That was the babies. I know I just broke a major college radio rule. I actually played a commercial hit, but I found it in my singles, and I love that song. I think I'll tell the dirty secret. Michael Stipe likes it, too.
That's great.
First of all, was he a good DJ?
Oh, he was great. He was the dream DJ that you would want up there. He had a great collection of records and knew something about all of them.
How did you get him to do it? 5 hours.
I'm not entirely sure myself. It was just sort of an invitation that myself and a couple of friends thought we might extend to REM. WUOG was moving from its original location where it had been some at least 3 decades, probably more. And we just thought it would be cool to have someone who had a history and a connection to the station come up. And we had no idea that Mike would stay for 5 hours. We thought it would just be sort of a hour-long kind of thing. And it kept going, and it was wonderful.
Well, if you're just joining us, we're speaking about a new documentary called REM by MTV. And with us, we have, you just heard, Jordan Stepp. She DJed with Mike Mills for about 5 hours when she was in college, but she is now at the Athens Music Junkie blog. And also with us is producer Alex Young, who helped create the documentary, and editor David Leopold. Most of these clips are from your documentary, and this is Michael Stipe talking about being a Southern band. And I have to say, when I mention that REM is from Georgia, people who didn't know that already are usually surprised, because it's not what people think of as a band from the South. So here's Michael Stipe.
As far as being a Southern band goes, whoever that guy that writes for the Village Voice that keeps saying that we may as well be from Chicago, you know, he's really wrong. I mean, if he's expecting cowboy hats and spurs and really twangy vocals, if that's his idea of Southern, then he's really wrong.
What kind of Southern identity does Michael Stipe or anyone else in the band have?
I think it was interesting for me really going back and listening to the back catalog and going through each album along the way and really hearing those Southern influences throughout their music. I think there's a tendency, at least for those of us in the North, to think of Southern music as either the country western or Southern rock.
Lynyrd Skynyrd, right.
Yeah, exactly. But there's definitely those Southern elements that you just probably wouldn't hear coming out of bands forming in the North.
Like what?
I think that there's an honesty that's not coupled with angst that you're really getting from this band. And I think that there are stereotypes for each region of this country and what it means for the culture and society and the music that comes from it. But I don't think that you can really label the South as one brand of music. And I think REM really spoke to that.
Well, let me take that to our Southern girl, Jordan. What do you hear in REM's music that you identify with either Athens or the South?
Well, pretty much all of it,
really?
To be honest. Yeah. Well, I was born and raised in the South, and some of the songs and the albums and the imagery that they evoke in these pieces is what I grew up with. It just evokes these memories of hot summers and of these really incredible moments that you really only have in the South, where in Athens in particular, you have a very interesting and forward-thinking art scene coupled with pastures full of cows just maybe 10 minutes drive from here. And it's definitely it's a clash between the sort of cultural stereotypes, but it really comes through in REM's music. And it's just something that is inherently Southern.
Is there any song that comes to mind when you think about a real connection to Athens?
South Central Rain is definitely one of the ones that I connect with Athens, just on a personal level, because you can see walking out onto a front porch and just watching the rain come down, and it's as if you were in a music video almost, because you're in the South, you're looking at this rain, and you can hear South Central Rain, and it just, it connects. The conversation
So I wanted to go back to something, David, that we discussed earlier, which is sort of the honesty without a lot of dressing on it, just sort of blunt, sincere honesty. And I think we hear that a lot, especially in things like Automatic for the People. In that album especially, they talk about death more than once. And this is something from a clip, an interesting exchange between Mike Mills and Michael Stipe in the documentary. Take a listen.
You don't want to have too much attitude when you're talking about your own mortality or anyone else's mortality, because death always wins.
Yeah, God.
How about that?
Ultimately, for me, that record is very uplifting.
Yeah.
But it does deal with a very dark subject, and one that maybe rock listeners aren't used to dealing with on that level, or with that level of vulnerability and openness.
Fitting that we come out of that sentiment, dealing with vulnerability and openness, into Everybody Hurts, because that song is just so laid bare. And I wonder, did you get a sense that the band ever struggled with being that vulnerable?
I'm not sure if they ever really struggled with vulnerability. I think that they never really seemed to show fear of showing their vulnerability. They always seemed like they were very honest in what they were doing. They were being of the moment. They were really putting themselves out there, both musically and lyrically. And they also had no real problem switching between being honest and genuine and being tongue-in-cheek or having fun. And they really seemed to walk that line very well.
Well, let's do one more musical example here, and that's, I guess, of the sense of humor that we were talking about earlier. This is a clip from the 1991 song Shiny Happy People. In case you didn't get the joke, the band later appeared on Sesame Street to spoof their own kind of spoofy song. So, Jordan, I'm going to give the last question to you, and I'm going to ask you to do something kind of difficult, because I want you to set aside your Athens bias for just a second. And I'm going to approach you as a music expert here. REM became really the first indie band to break through into the top 40, the top 20, even the top 10. Why? What was it about REM's music that broke through in a way that other indie bands hadn't been able to before?
Well, I think if we knew exactly why, there would be a lot more popular indie bands breaking through. But for the most part, I think it is a lot of that sincerity, and it wasn't an overnight thing. The band toured relentlessly. They recorded relentlessly. They worked hard, and they were trailblazers, but they also had the backing of independent venues. They had the backing of college radio stations. They just really appealed to that non-mainstream, and that kept going. That stayed with them. And I think part of that was the sincerity and honesty that they approached pretty much every aspect of their business with.
That was my 2014 conversation with Jordan Stepp, who runs the Athens Music Junkie blog, and producer Alex Young and editor Dave Leopard. They made the 2014 MTV documentary REM. The reissue of Out of Time goes on sale November 18th. For our Georgia playlist, we ask people to tell us what two songs they think best represent the Peach State. The rules are really simple. Nominations have to be songs written or performed by a Georgian, and it can't be one of their own songs if they're a musician. It's the Georgia playlist, and we're going to add two more tracks from a very familiar Georgia voice.
One, two, three.
Hi, my name is Kate Pearson from the B-52s, and also from Kate Pearson, Guitars and Microphones, my solo record. My first choice of songs from a Georgia artist, Augusta G.A., Hot Pants, James Brown.
Take your pants up on, it looks much better time, my feet will keep going.
James Brown is unique, and there's just something raw and beautiful and it's eternal. You know, it's like it doesn't age. That song does not age. It doesn't ever sound old, any of James Brown's stuff, you know, and I think a lot of artists feel that way, that he's on one of the top of the list.
Hot man, make you shoot yourself. Good God, you won't like you.
Back in the day when the B-52s started, we would dance at the drop of a hat. We'd go over to our friend John Taylor's house. He'd bake cornbread. He was always cooking, so we gravitated to his house. And he'd put on James Brown or Shotgun or something, and we would just dance around the table. We would dance with that cornbread. We would dance, you know, in the middle of the day. So James Brown was one of those people that you could not stop dancing. If Hot Pants was on, you had to get up and dance.
Do you like it?
Hot pants. Smoking. Okay, the second song on my list of Georgia artists from Macon, Georgia, Tutti Frutti by Little Richard.
Tutti Frutti. Oh,
it's the same kind of thing as James Brown in a way. You can't stop dancing, and he's also sort of the king of rock and roll, or the one of the fathers of rock and roll. It's one of those songs that you could say, okay, the lyrics really are genius in their simplicity.
She rock to the east, she rock to the west, but she's the gal that I love best.
You know, people just say, like, oh, what do these crazy lyrics mean? You know, sometimes they'll take B-52 songs out of context and, you know, they'll read the lyrics and say, this is just so, like, how can this be a song? But, you know, this is an example of these lyrics, which apparently he got from some teenage girl, I think. He overheard, or she said Tutti Frutti. But, you know, you get your inspiration from wherever. But, I mean, that is just so genius the way he put that together. And it's just, in some ways, nonsense, but in some ways it's the most profound thing you could ever sing. Tutti Frutti. Oh, Rudy. Tutti Frutti. Nobody could sing like Little Richard. He's one of a kind. Also, like growing up, you know, gay and Macon, I mean, he's got to be like made of some tough stuff. And I think he's just, you know, just such a brave person to grow up, you know, and do the music he did. And I just think he blazed a trail. I don't think there's one particular sound for the state. No, there's just, Athens is a unique sound. I think Macon had its sound, certainly. And there's a, I think, the really big rap scene in Atlanta. So there's an Atlanta sound, I think, too. And there's a lot of creativity in Georgia.
That was singer-songwriter Kate Pearson of the B-52s with her picks for our ever-growing Essential Georgia Playlist. That's our show for today, but what album do you think should get a reissue, and what band would you like to see reunite? Call us at 404-500-9457 to leave a message. We're also on Twitter. It's at OSD Talk. You can find me at Celeste Headley, or just post to Facebook. For today, that is On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day.